as someone comforted by his mother, this is the way I shall comfort you in consoling Jerusalem. And that, little children, is our daily scripture from Isaiah 66, verse 13. For today, from my own translation of 2003. So, it shows the tenderness of the true God, the way he treats the city of Jerusalem, which means the city of twofold peace, of course. It means twofold peace. Shalom is peace. Jerusalem is twofold peace. And I think in verse 10 we saw that it said the city of twofold peace already. So that was the reason for that. That's what the word Jerusalem actually means. So we've made it to paragraph 8 in chapter 7 of the Ark of Urartu. And I wrote in 2011 on March 13th at 1343 hours, quoting now from the paragraph, we're going to read this paragraph. Something made me smile today, I wrote. And then a quote, if the trumpet sounds an indistinct call, who is getting ready for battle? Yeah, right. So, yes, being unambiguous is important, right? If we want people, or just, you know, specific people to respond to us, we need to be clear, right? Abigail encouraged David by saying that his soul was safe, bound up securely in the bag of life with Jehovah his God. That's a beautiful expression, bound up in the bag of life. I mean, only in the Hebrew language do we see these expressions, these poetic expressions, like the face of the earth. That's a Hebrew expression. The bag of life, another Hebrew expression. To execute vengeance upon the nations. This is quoting from Psalm 149. Rebukes upon the national groups, to bind their kings with shackles and their glorified ones with fetters of iron, to execute upon them the judicial decision written. Such splendor belongs to all his loyal ones. Praise Jah, you people. So Jehovah's loyal ones have this ability to, wow. I mean, it's saying to have that kind of splendor is something that belongs to Jehovah's loyal ones. Specifically, that kind of splendor that enables those ones to execute vengeance upon nations, you know, national groups, to be able to rebuke them and bind their kings with shackles. I mean, this is a very great privilege that Jehovah's loyal ones have. They have immense power. It's reminding me that I'm thinking of Joseph, you know, and how Joseph got his power in Egypt after having been in prison, but he got power because the righteousness of Joseph became evident to everyone, and his ability to interpret dreams and things like that was part of his righteousness. It was a gift given to him because he maintained integrity, right? And that was a big part of it. I mean, that's always a part of it. But of course, he had these gifts that were rather unusual. But he maintained integrity, and he kept rising in the ranks. Even when he was put in prison in Egypt, he was put in prison, right? And he even rose in the ranks in the prison, became appointed as a person of, you know, having a supervisory role in the prison, or being in a position of power in the prison, before he was released from the prison by the Pharaoh and appointed to be the ruler of the second in command, but essentially the ruler of all of Egypt. The acting chief of Egypt, the acting Pharaoh, was what he was when he was put in that position by the Pharaoh. The Pharaoh gave him his own ring, signet ring, and he gave him a chariot, the second chariot of Pharaoh. And that's where we get the illustration of the god Poseidon riding a chariot, right? The god Poseidon rode a chariot, and that fits Joseph because he rode this chariot around Egypt. And he was appointed by Pharaoh because he had interpreted Pharaoh's dream as saying that there was going to be a famine, and that he also advised Pharaoh, actually, as well. But he said that Pharaoh should store up all the foodstuffs because there was going to be, first, before the famine, 7 years of plenty, and they should store up all the foodstuffs. I'm always fascinated when I watch archaeological videos where they're looking at Egypt and they find these deep holes in the ground in some places in Egypt. Particularly, I'm thinking about the Giza Plateau where the Great Pyramid is. And, well, that could be where they put the grain, right? In these deep holes in the ground. It makes perfect sense to me, but everybody who's looking at these deep holes, for the most part, they're baffled by it. They have no clue, what are these holes in the ground? You know, it's when we read the Bible, we're always looking for explanations. You know, I mean, to use the Bible as an explanation for things we see around us. And, you know, it's not always going to be explaining every single little thing. Perhaps immediately we don't see it, but in cases like that, it's so clear. Thanks, I write, to all of the many humble ones, and to these glory. And of course, Joseph was very humble. He was sold into slavery by his brothers, but before that, he had had a dream which showed that his brothers, or at least the sheaves in the field belonging to his brothers, bowed down to the sheaf of Joseph, and that was one of the dreams. And then there was another dream about stars and how these things seemed to indicate that Joseph's brothers and his family, his parents as well, were going to be in obeisance to Joseph. They would obey him. And of course it came true, because later on Joseph was in command of Egypt and he had all the grain, and there was a famine and his family needed to go down to Egypt. according to Demetrius, 3,625 years after. I'm trying to think, what is that? 3,625 years after Adam? I think it's after Adam. Oh, let's just do a calculation, yeah. It was a great... The ancient Jewish... chronologer, Demetrius, did this calculation. But he said, let's just see what we find here. 5550, which is our date for Adam, subtract 3625. And it's not going to be correct because there it is, 1925, right. But there, we know that, I'm thinking, let's see. Yeah, it's something like 22 generations. From Adam down to Joseph, it's something like 22 generations. That's correct. So if you count them up from, you know, from Adam to Noah, it's something like 10 generations inclusive, I think. And then from Noah down to, wait a minute now, Abraham is about 10, right? Yeah, that's right. So then Joseph is the son of Jacob, who's the son of Isaac, who's the son of Abraham. He's the great-grandson of Abraham. So that's, and so we have 9 generations, and 10 is 19, and 3 is 22 generations from Adam to Joseph. So this number, 1925, really needs to have another 22 generations, or another 11 years, since each of those years that were given by Demetrius could have been wrong by 6 months. In other words, it just rounded off to the nearest year. So 22 years, each of which is inaccurate by half a year, means that on average, some of them will be that number of years plus 11 months, some will be plus 1 month. On average, it's plus 6 months. So we're going to say 11 years out of 22, or half a year for each year, we have to add on. It's 1936 is what we get. I'm sorry, but that would be if I went in that direction. But we want to subtract it. Yeah, we want to subtract it simply because it takes 11 years longer when you add the extra 6 months or half year to each of those 22 generations, right? So it's 1914. That's the actual year, the year before the Common Era. It just coincides with the second, or not the second, the first World War, right? It just coincides perfectly with the Great War. And at its beginning, it's the mirror date. 1914 CE was the Great War's beginning. But 1914 BCE was when Israel came down to Egypt, according to Demetrius, with this 11-year adjustment that we made. And so it's just such a great thing that we had this ancient historian, Demetrius. And this is what we haven't read yet, but it's in the article Joseph. But we will perhaps read that article soon or at some point. It's in the article Joseph, or Joseph and Owen, the second one, the one after Joseph, where we talk about how we arrive, or in both of the articles, we talk about what the time period was, you know, for these events in Egypt. But it's we're off topic. Sorry about that. I just was reminded about Joseph, and then I remembered some of the interesting things about that, one of which was Demetrius. But without any historical writers, without any chronologers, we'd really be lost. We'd be lacking in anything concrete, you know, as far as information. It's terrible. As far as information goes, we'd be completely destitute if we didn't have the ancient sources, right? I mean, we can't use astronomy if we don't have an ancient source to compare it with. I mean, we use astronomy to help verify. But, I mean, if we just had an ancient source saying there was an eclipse, and there are very few of those recorded, but if we just had that, that wouldn't be enough, right, to pinpoint the date if we didn't have a clue what time period it was. Because, you know, eclipses do occur in the same location after a certain number of years. Usually it's quite a large number of years if you're looking for a total eclipse of the sun or something like that, you know, in the same location. I think it's something like 100 years or something. It takes a long time for that same event to occur again with regard to that kind of celestial phenomenon. But the celestial phenomenon were given to us by the incredible, you know, intelligence, the incredible configuration contained in the solar system that was created, right? I mean, if it hadn't been created exactly as it was, with the moon exactly the right size, there wouldn't be any eclipses. I mean, everything had to be in line so that occasionally there would be an eclipse. If it happened that every single year there was an eclipse, or every month there was an eclipse, it wouldn't tell us anything about anything, right? The fact that it is the way it is was by design, you could say, because it enables us to do this timekeeping after the fact, many years and centuries, in fact, afterwards. 1001, now we're not talking about eclipses today per se, but 1001 hours, I wrote right next to this beautiful photo of a flower here. Red and orange flower with these penduline petals sort of projecting outwards in all directions, of course, but very elongated with a sort of a wedge shape. And I remembered why I wrote this about silver for the governor. It's because, and I had written that in Chinese, but it's because this Sumerian account was an account of silver for the governor. That was in fact the words that were contained on this clay tablet that we had looked at at the beginning of paragraph 7-7. So I was comparing the symbols on that clay tablet, which was a particular account of silver for the governor. In fact, the Sumerian governor, it was dated about 2500 BCE. But you see those symbols? And then I was comparing those with the Chinese words, silver for the governor, or something like that, whatever it said there, something close to that account of silver for the governor was what the Sumerian tablet had said. Okay. So let's go back to where we were. Right, we're just about finished. How true is the saying about loud morning voices? Right, there's a saying about that in the Bible that if you bless someone with a loud voice early in the morning, it's more like you're calling down evil upon them. Because in the morning, we're not ready to hear loud voices, right? We're not able to accept a blessing in a loud voice for that reason. Now, 10:26 hours, I wrote, now, do we follow those who do or those who talk? Right. Christ was our exemplar. He set an example by what he did. He didn't just talk. Right? I mean, yeah, we wouldn't want to be a blabbermouth, would we? None of us would, I don't think, want to be thought of like that. But we have an obligation to do some things. Once we can't just talk, we have to do something. I know, you know, some people don't like to think, they just like to do things. But other people like to think and plan and do, and then sometimes the people who think and plan a lot have people trying to get them to take action, you know, trying to egg them on and so on, trying to make them do something. I'm thinking of my own experience and how I sometimes am like that, where I like to plan and think. And I've had people say, I think they get frustrated with me, and so they try to get me to just do something instead of talking or thinking. Actually, I'm not really talking. If I'm thinking about something, I'm not talking about it. Although planning, it's good to talk to somebody if you're planning something. But 10:40 hours, the last thing I wrote was, "Kiss the Son that he may not be angry." That's from Psalm chapter 2, verse 12. Yeah, right, the whole world gathers together against God's anointed one, too, it says. Let's see if we could look at that. But Amazon did an amazing thing recently. They delivered this heat pump that I ordered. It was a portable heat pump. In Psalm 2 and 2, it says, "The kings of the earth take their stand, and high officials themselves have massed together as one against Jehovah and against his anointed one." Verse 12 says, "Kiss the Son that he may not become incensed." Right? Very important. To see both the beginning and the end of that, to tie that together, just to show that, you know, even if the whole earth is against the true God and his Son Jesus, his anointed representative, they need to be aware, right, that they're in danger if they don't kiss the Son in a figurative way. Kiss the Son, it says. In other words, be welcoming of Jesus is what the warning is there, because if you don't, you know, he might become angry, and that is not going to be good for the nations. Okay, if that happens, if they don't kiss the Son, just kiss the Son. That's what it's entreating them to do. That's it for today for the study, but Amazon delivered this heat pump in a remarkably short time. It was supposed to be like sometime between the 27th of November and I forget what the final date was. It might have even been January when they were expecting it to be delivered, or they weren't promising it would be fast, but yet, thank you, whoever was responsible for that, because that was a very nice thing. I wasn't prepared to install it immediately. I was aware it was supposed to take a long time, but whenever I need it, whenever I'm ready, whenever I can figure out, I need to figure out where to put it, because if I install it upstairs, it's going to be perfect, of course, in the summer to blow cold air at me, But in the winter, if it's blowing, you know, it's a heat pump. It doesn't blow super hot air. In the winter, it might be blowing air that's not quite so hot, but, you know, it just, it's not going to be hotter than body temperature, you know. So it might be, it's going to make me cold if I'm blowing the air on myself. I've got to figure out how I'm going to deflect the air, or maybe I should use it to heat some other part of the house and indirectly heat myself. I'll still use my local heaters regardless. I'll still have a local heater on my legs anyway, no matter what, because that's always going to be the case as long as my legs are cold, you know, which they generally are. Excuse me. But, you know, where to put this? I bought it because it will fit perfectly right where the air conditioner is right now. And I can keep it there all year round because it'll do heating and cooling. But, you know, I can also put it in the basement where I already have one running. And the one that I've got down there is capable of doing something, but I'm not sure if it's capable of heating the whole basement, or even if I want it to do that all winter, you know. But I've also bought these shrink wrap window window kit, you know, for the sealing up the windows. And it's shrink wrap that you tape over top of the window frame. It's like a storm window, essentially. You know, it gives you another gap of air protection from the outside by putting the shrink wrap, so there's no drafts or air, cold air coming in. That should increase the insulation, you know, of the house by doing that basically on all my windows, but I'm not sure yet. I haven't started doing that yet either. But it's still not getting all that cold yet. But once it gets colder, I'm sure I'll be able to see the importance of getting these things installed, you know. But I needed to get that heater, I thought, because it's I know that I'm going to regret, just because it's such great. It's a cheaper way to do it. Like, it takes less money to transfer heat from one point to the other using a heat pump. Like, from, you can transfer heat from outside into your house in the winter, and that takes less money than generating heat electrically. It's cheaper. I don't know how that is, though, come to think of it. Because these heat pumps, well, they're not running all the time, I guess, either, right? But when they're running, they might take, you know, 9 or 10 amps for a significant size one. Yeah, it takes 9 or 10 amps, which is, 9 or 10 amps is a kilowatt, you know. So, I'm trying to think what a kilowatt, whereas a heater, like, I've got a heater that's 800 watts here, it goes off and on, off and on. But, oh, the power of that heat pump is really good, because, especially in the basement, and I can easily have two of them in the basement if I want, so. Each time I install them, I have to do some work on it, though, you know, like, to get the exhaust hose to go out the window, I have to build a panel with a hole in it the right size. Yeah, and I had to buy a piece of a flange of a steel flange that I could, you know, tape the hose onto, and then and tape that onto the wooden panel that I put in place of the window screen. My windows don't slide, so I can't use the sliding kit that comes with these things. So I have to put in my own piece of, like, I get a piece of wood the right size, like a piece of plywood or something. Whatever I have available, particle board or plywood. But I've got some Baltic plywood that I got from Finland, I guess, or something like that, that I can use. It doesn't quite fill the whole window in the height of the window, you know, but I can use... Well, I could cut another piece off and glue it, you know. I can make multi-layer pieces of panels and stuff if I need to make it fit. The panel I've got in there now has just got a gap at the top. Where it's only one half its own, about half of its thickness in the final couple of inches or something. But I've got to insulate that panel, I think, too, so that it doesn't lose too much heat. You know, but I think it's pretty good compared to glass. I think it'll be it's reasonably good. I tape it up with, you know, weather stripping, make sure it's sealed up well. So how are my watches doing? Annie's running fine. I checked and she's running really good. I think she's running fast now instead of slow, so that's good. That's really good. Forget how fast was she. But not too bad. Just running a little fast instead of slow, which is better than before, but I'm not wearing Annie right now. And she did stop on me when I was trying to regulate her, right? That was surprising, but that's the hacking watch. She does hacking. And it just made me think, you know, the Rolex homage that was made by Pagani, that I call Raleigh, she stops, and she was hacking, a Chinese hacking movement. The hacking part stops the second hand, you see? So if the hacking part is somehow malfunctioning, maybe it's stopping the second hand when it shouldn't be. So I think it's the hacking part of it that can cause these things to stop. And Annie is a hacking watch, just like Raleigh is, whereas Sissy's not hacking. The second hand never stops on Sissy. So that prevents that kind of a problem, where the second hand would stop for no reason if the hacking malfunctioned. So that gives me a clue as to what I might try to do to fix Raleigh. Is find out more about how the hacking mechanism is working and try to fix it once I figure out what I'm doing. But, you know, it's just a hobby. And I think that I said that Star was like several hundred. I think Star is more like a couple of $1,000. I forget. I'll have to look it up again. It's a very expensive watch, and it was not a very recent model. But still, it's the Seiko luxury brand. This is Sissy, and this is Star, saying bye for now. I'm Ward Green. I love you very much. I love you. I love you. I love you. It's nice to be with you. I'm just about at the end of the study now. It's November 21st, 2024 of the Common Era, 1757 hours, North American Eastern Time. So that's it for today. And I love you. Did I mention?